tell you what, folks, we're going to do something a bit different tonight. We are, as a matter of fact, just beginning to turn the corner and start another Torah cycle. That means we are in Bereshit. And I'll introduce it this time this way by saying that when it comes to the Bible's first book, Genesis in English, Bereshit in the Hebrew. Why? Because those, of course, are the first couple of words, at least the way they're normally parsed. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim v'et haaretz in the Hebrew. And this is one of those verses that I just love memorizing because it's interesting in so many ways. So I'll start it this way. I started to say we're going to do things a little bit different. And here's why. This is probably one of the primary times when we go through the Torah that I regret that we're on the annual cycle. In other words, that we go through the whole Torah every year, because this portion is just plain huge. As has been pointed out, it covers the better part of two millennia, certainly well over 1,000 years. That's a lot to take in one fell swoop, but it's also got some of the most incredible meat, an incredible depth, packing, if you will, of information of anything in the Torah. And that's saying an incredible amount. So even if we were on a three-year cycle, 3 weeks for this is just plain not enough. So what I try to do, at least on Erev Shabbat tonight, is to go through it. That's an almost impossible task, so I'm going to focus a little bit in a couple of places. What I tended to do in years past is pick a specific aspect and go into a little bit more detail. I may do some of that tomorrow, because there are just so many wonderful parts here that are so key for everything that comes up that it's impossible really to do it anything approaching justice. But I'll start it this way. I'm gonna do what I said, and that is rearrange things just a bit. I still intend to try to go through the whole portion, or at least hit the highlights of the whole thing. And I'm going to break it a bit differently than I often do. I'm going to talk a little bit. Okay, I'll be a little bit circumspect. I'm going to talk a little bit about what I'm going to talk about. And then we'll do the news. And then we'll come back. And we'll talk a little bit about the overview in a couple of different ways. So I'm going to spend just a few minutes on a specific aspect of the Torah portion after I make one or two more introductory remarks. Like I said, this is huge. Covers a whole lot of time, including the entire creation, right? I had some questions this week, people write and ask, gee, do you believe in the gap theory? The gap theory, if you haven't heard, it says that between Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim v'et haaretz, in the beginning, Elohim created the heavens and the earth. Well, in between that one and verse 2, how much time was there? The gap theory says maybe there might have been a whole lot of time. Maybe there was war in heaven. Maybe there was a lot of things that transpired in there. Why? Well, because it says, now the earth was unformed and void. And in the Hebrew, I like the Hebrew so much better in a lot of cases. It says, ve ha'aretz, and the earth. Basically, it was bohu, tohu v'bohu. It almost rhymes in the Hebrew. Tohu v'bohu, void and unformed. And some have suggested that when you talk about void there, it means that, kind of like what you, that's a word that you might use after a nuclear war to describe what was going on. Darkness was upon the face of the deep. The Spirit of Yah hovered over the face of the waters. That actually says Elohim there. And Elohim said, let there be light, and there was light. Do I believe in the gap theory? I can't deny it. Certainly it makes sense, because there's nothing in the Scripture that would say differently than that. But again, there's also nothing that we can read here that says that was absolutely positively what was going on either. One more, maybe several more comments about verse 1. I've mentioned that this is a huge, incredible exposition to the most important book ever written. And in the Hebrew, if you just look at the first, 7, 8 dozen characters there in the Hebrew language, and you look at a Torah scroll, you'll notice that they are there's no spaces in them. So how do we know that it says Bereshit bara Elohim et Hashemayim vayet haaretz? Answer, somebody put spaces and vowel pointers in and said this is what it says. But you can actually parse it. You can put spaces in different places, and you can find other interesting ways to parse that sentence, all of which are meaningful. Now, that's why I say you could spend a lot of time talking about this, and in years past, I have. But literally, there's just plain not time. That word bara, for example, is a word that means created ex nihilo, literally out of nothing. Physicists get a big kick out of that concept. There's difference between created and made, or formed. We're going to later talk about forming. He's going to form Adam. But here, at least it seems to be bara. But there are other ways. Bar ish, those first two words. The son of man, the healer of man. There's ish is another word that could be rendered with different vowel pointings as fire. The creator of the fire, or the explosion, was El. Huh. So again, lots of ways of looking at that. Well, let's do this. Let's then just cut to the chase and say, we've heard a lot of this. I'm going to come back to pieces of it. But let me ask this question. If I said, what's the essential story in the Torah portion here? What's the thing that's most important? Well, some folks would say, well, it all has to do with creation. This is the story of the most important event in history. It was the very creation of everything out of nothingness. And even in the volume of material that we've got, even in these six chapters that cover this incredible amount of time, it's kind of fascinating that the author of the book only chose to put literally just a very few stories in there. There's so much more that could be said about the first, thousand or more years of human history. For example, how about the creation or the discovery by man of fire? Isn't that important? How about the first wheel? Doesn't mention any of those things. Does spend a little bit of time talking about the first man and the first woman. We'll come back to that again. How about the first rebellion, the first sin? Some say the fall. And, of course, the first murder. Even putting away this concept of, later on it gets twisted and called divorce, but of separation, of sending out. We see first the man and the woman. Adam v'Chava, Adam and Eve, are sent away. They're kicked out of the garden. They're divorced. They're exiled. Similarly, later, we see a very similar thing happening with Cain. Cain. Which is the most important story? Well, let's focus at least for a couple minutes on this. I'm looking at what I thought was a fascinating piece among any numbers of various midrashim, of midrashes, of commentaries and that are and could be and have been written about this fascinating book. This one comes from Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. I've referenced him before. He's one of my favorites that I look at from time to time. He has a piece entitled The Art of Listening is up there, exploring the first sin. All right, and really, let's ask the question. It's a great question. What exactly are we talking about? What was the first sin? What was this tree of the knowledge of good and evil? And is this knowledge really such a bad thing that it needed to be forbidden? And it was rebellion by which it was required. Isn't somehow or other, at least we would presume, that knowing the difference between good and evil ain't such a bad thing. Some would even argue that it's essential to being human. It's a key form of knowledge, yada, yada, yada. Surely, say some of the sages, wouldn't Elohim have wanted humans to have it? So why did he forbid whatever kind of fruit it is that provides it? And furthermore, you got to ask some other questions. Adam and Eve, didn't they have some knowledge about what good and evil was before they ate this fruit anyway? Because, after all, a couple things make sense. They were created in his image. That seems to imply something. He also gave them commands like be fruitful and multiply, have dominion, and oh, by the way, don't eat from that tree. If people are going to understand a command, they have to at least know enough about good and evil to know that not doing what he says is wrong somehow, that it's bad, it's evil to disobey. So you have to ask a bunch of questions, including what really changed when they ate this fruit. Now here he fast forwards a long time and quotes one of the favorite scholars, sages, men of renown, if you will, throughout the history of Judaism, the Maimonides, a.k.a. the Rambam. And he wrote a very famous book a long time ago called Guide for the Perplexed. And he gave an answer that, indeed, say some folks, is perplexing itself. Because he claims that before they ate the fruit, these first humans knew the difference, not necessarily between good and evil, but between truth and falsehood. And he claims that what they got when they ate the fruit, now listen to this, because I hadn't seen this before, I thought this was kind of fascinating, was the knowledge about things generally accepted. Now when I see stuff like that, folks, I pause and I say, wait a minute, now something is really fishy here. They got knowledge about things generally accepted. What does he mean by that, for crying out loud? Well, people might have said things like, well, murder is bad. Don't do murder. And honesty is good. And yet we see here in this very Torah portion a problem with Cain. He doesn't seem to have that complete understanding. So what is all of this? Is he saying that morality is just whatever we make it today? Well, surely not. When I read this, the first thing I started thinking of, and I'm departing from what Rabbi Sachs is suggesting here, and picking up a little bit more of the teachings that we find a long time later with Yehoshua, having to do with tradition. By your traditions, he said, you have replaced the commandments of God. You've decided your own tradition. In other words, things that you guys generally accept, you have decided that is superior to things that are put in genuine print for you by the Creator of the universe in His Word. To my mind, when I see things generally accepted, in other words, I start to think about, well, what else has been generally accepted? This whole concept of paganism. But hey, doesn't that kind of take us back to Genesis chapter 3 anyway? Things that were generally accepted, certainly things that are generally accepted now have their roots right there in the original lie. You can be like God, you will not die. Somehow or other, I guess what fascinates me about this particular essay is that it goes to the heart of so many pieces of the story that literally we could spend hours talking about each aspect of, and it kind of combines them all together. All right, well, one other thing. What else do we know about the story and what happened after they ate the fruit? Well, they were embarrassed. They were naked. Who told you you were naked, right? That is, what does that mean? Is it generally accepted that being naked was something didn't bother them before? Now it does. Why? Is that a matter of social convention? Not everyone everywhere clearly is embarrassed by nudity. You go into a lot of places out in the true boondocks, you know, in the Aboriginal tribes, 1,000 miles from nowhere, a lot of people running around naked, National Geographic kinds of stuff. Can we somehow equate being embarrassed with a knowledge of good and evil? And ultimately, maybe we're talking about aesthetics here more than ethics or... so confusing, right? Well, Rabbi Sachs tells a story that I think was pretty valuable. He says, if you go back and look at history, and in particular the Second World War, a fascinating thing came out. Now, the war, essentially, between the United States and the Pacific Theater was Japan. Japan was, in fact, and to some extent is, nowadays with modern communications, a lot of things is not as much so as it was, but particularly in those days, it was a radically different culture. Also very pagan. If you recall, it was understood in the World War II era that the Japanese regarded the emperor as a god, certainly not the first society to have that particular little twist. So they commissioned a great anthropologist of the day, a woman named Ruth Benedict, to explain the Japanese culture to them, which she did. And later, she published all this. The book was called The Chrysanthemum and the Sword. But the central insight, among several, was that she defined cultures that have a different basis. And this word, too, is one that I'm going to come back to after we talk about some of the rest of Genesis, of Bereshit here. It's this word difference. There's a difference between cultures. There is a difference between the Japanese culture and the American culture. And she referred to them as the following: shame cultures and guilt cultures. Now, I'm not sure if I think the distinction is exactly on line with where I would parse this as far as the Torah is concerned, but it's an interesting way to think about and understand a few of the differences we're talking about here. The highest value that a shame culture places on something is honor, right? Face, saving face. You might have heard it that way. But in guilt cultures, and she suggests that Americans, at least once upon a time, were a guilt culture, it's about righteousness. Now that name, that word, really strikes a chord with this. What's righteousness? It's Torah obedience. It's the essence of what it is to be a tzaddik, one who knows about what it means to be righteous. Anyway, shame is feeling bad that we have failed to live up to the expectations that others have for us, whereas guilt, she said, is what we feel when we fail to live up to what our own conscience, our own inner view of ourselves, or maybe our understanding of what we are or who we are before God, demands of us. So here's the bottom line. Shame is directed outwards at other people, and the culture that puts shame as the highest issue, thing to be avoided, has an outward direction, whereas guilt and guilt cultures are inwardly directed. Okay, now there's a little bit more to it, and this is where I think it actually gets more interesting, so bear with me a bit here. Philosophers, says the rabbi, have pointed out that if you look at shame cultures, like the Japanese, you will find that they are generally visually oriented. Because if you think about it, shame is about how you appear, or you think you appear, in the eyes of other people. So the instinctive reaction, if you feel shame, is to try to pretend you're invisible, or disappear, or be somewhere else. Whereas guilt, as we've already mentioned, is a lot more internalized. You can't escape it by being invisible, because your conscience accompanies you wherever you go. So, if you will, there's a difference here, too, between shame cultures and guilt cultures. The former is appearance-oriented. The latter is hearing-oriented. Listening, what you hear, rather than what people see. So here you go. Back to where we started with this idea of Bereshit and the central story, if you will, having to do with rebellion to God. The first sin. Now, here, I think the rabbi makes a really key point. This is why we're going through this whole thing, and it's how I wanted to set this this teaching up tonight. Sin, the first sin, if you step back and look at it, was all about appearances. About shame, about vision, who told you you were naked, and about things like the eye. How can you tell? What can you see? How do you know you're naked? Well, it's a visual. It's an appearance. It's an eye thing. And furthermore, look at some of the specific verses. Now, at this point, I know most of you have read this, so think about the following. The serpent, Nachash, he says to Chava, at this point she's the woman, he says, Elohim knows that on the day you eat this thing, this fruit, your eyes will be opened, and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. And then later on, and I usually emphasize this, once Adam ratifies her bad decision, this takes us to Numbers 30, once he too fails to do what he ought to have done, then it says the eyes of both of them were opened. Again, emphasis on eyes. And then they realized they were naked. It's the appearance of the tree, too, and how good-looking the fruit is that Torah emphasizes to us. So everything about this story has to do with the eyes and the appearances. The woman saw the tree was good to eat. It was desirable to the eyes. The tree was attractive as a means to gain intelligence. The key emotion in the story is all about shame and what the eyes see, the eyes want. Every element of the story. The fruit, the tree, the nakedness, the shame, what they feel after they eat it, is all about the visual element that is typical of a shame culture. And by the way, as I've pointed out, of a pagan culture. A culture that is different from one that's described in Torah. So here is where he draws a couple conclusions. If you look at Torah and you understand, he puts it in the sense of here's what Judaism teaches. I think basically this is one of the messages of Torah. It's all about the fact that no one can see Elohim, right? Can't see him and live. He is heard rather than seen. He spoke the world into existence. The first humans didn't see God. They heard his voice moving about in the garden with the wind of the day. And when Adam responds to Elohim after this fall, he says, I heard your voice in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid. I heard his voice. They hid themselves from him. But kind of silly, right? How can you hide from a voice anyway? Funny stuff. So here's how he puts it. I think this is a way to look at it that I had never looked at before. The sin of the first humans in the Garden of Eden, yeah, it was rebellion. But how'd they get there? They followed their eyes and not their ears. Their actions were determined by what they saw, and they were for appearances' sake, rather than what they heard. What was it they were supposed to be hearing and obeying? Yeah, same thing we are today. The word of Elohim. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of Yah. Where have we heard that before? All of this stuff is true. In other words, they fell for appearances' sake rather than for what was true. They failed to draw the distinction between true and false, and this is back to Maimonides and the way he puts it, and things generally accepted. What is it that's generally accepted? Well, it's appearances' sake. And I do think that's probably a better way of putting it. So the whole point here is, let's not be deceived by appearances. The drama, concludes Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, of Adam v'Chava, Adam and Eve, is not about apples or sex or original sin or the so-called fall. Those are all different twists that people will put on it. But it does, in fact, go deeper. Are we to be governed by what everyone else does, to put it in a modern sense, by appearances? Hey, how about politics, the will of the majority? Whose word matters? What are we listening to? Is it the word of Yah, or is it something else? Well, he puts it this way, there is a certain truth to listening, to the value of hearing, and it is, in fact, a sacred task. Don't be deceived by appearances, in other words. Learn to listen. Learn to read the word of Yah. Learn to follow what we can see. No, not with our eyes, but what we can see in the written pages. And this is part of the reason why I think it's valuable, too, to read Scripture out loud. Read it to your spouse. Read it to your children. Read it to one another so that you can actually hear it and let it be part of you. All right, we're going to pause at that point. We'll do this. We'll have a song. And then we will talk a little bit about the news, because I guess this is a week of appearances. And then we'll go back and we'll talk about the rest of the overview of all of this, see if we can't connect a few more dots. And I think when we put all that together, hopefully, maybe this is a different way of looking at a really, really meaty, huge section of Scripture that will yield a little bit more, no pun intended, fruit. All right, let's do the following. Let's talk first, just for a few minutes. I'll try to do this fairly briefly, but I think it's important to point out, just because we're talking about in the beginning, and we're talking about maybe the beginning of a whole different set of events in human history that are beginning to unfold, and to some extent there are certain bookends here. So, as always, we're supposed to be like the men of Issachar, at least I contend we ought to be, because they knew the times and the seasons. They knew what Israel ought to do. So let's talk a little bit about a couple of things. It was an incredibly active week in the news, and one that I think tells us we are really a heck of a lot closer to a cliff out there, even if we can't see where the cliff edge is, that looks like society in general, the world that is governed by appearances, is fixing to let its eyes guide it right over the edge of a nasty cliff. So a couple of things. First, follow the money. Certainly a lot of people will follow the money to their destruction. As far as a summary of the week goes, here's a pretty decent one from Michael Snyder, talking about, is there a great financial meltdown coming? The $2 quadrillion, an incredible amount of notional value, at least, of fiat, paper, fake money. How close is that to melting down? Well, there are some signs, at least. He suggested earlier this week that the great derivatives crisis has now begun. Remember, Warren Buffett once called derivatives the financial weapons of mass destruction. And there seems to have been something that happened in mid-December. Now, it's funny. You'll hear people talk about, oh, you know, the Shemitah came and went. Nothing happened. I'm thinking of all kinds of movies, right? Where the bad guy gets shot and it doesn't look like anything happens. Or the good guy gets shot. Ah, it's just flesh wound. Dead man walking is the term. Did something happen or did something not happen? Well, you got massive numbers of major economies with stock market meltdowns. Japan, the United States, in Europe, several of them. Certainly China is coming apart at the seams. And the something that happened in mid-September, say several analysts, seems to have required about $400+ billion surge of Treasury collateral being injected by the Fed into the repo market. Basically, this is the kind of thing that was done quietly, and yet it was huge. What's going on here? Somebody got in very serious trouble, and there have been a number of candidates raised. Hey, is this the Lehman Brothers moment? You know, it always happens over a weekend. Everything was fine on Friday. Monday morning, uh-oh, not so good. Earlier this week, there were there was a candidate for the meltdown that might set the whole thing in motion. It was a company called Glencore. That's a huge commodity company, and they were once the 10th largest company on the planet. Now they seem to be coming apart at the seams. Incredible amount of exposure in a tune of $100 billion, and then later on we find that Deutsche Bank too, the German central bank, has had a major meltdown. They lost something like $7 billion. Huge exposure there as well. Which one of them could it be? Well, who knows? Could be others as well. But the fact that something may have just blown up and been papered over is important to pay attention to. We'll just move on. Doctors Without Borders. A lot of people, I'm sure, heard this one over the weekend. The United States bombed the living hell out of a hospital that they knew precisely where it was, that it had well over 180 doctors and nurses and patients. A dozen of the staff of Doctors Without Borders were killed, 10 patients, including 3 children, and they are mad as hell about it. They have accused the United States and the Imperial Office of war crimes. And matter of fact, it seems to have gained some traction. There's even some suggestion that it was done deliberately. Hey, as a number of the people involved in this put it, you know, you guys brag about your smart bombs. You can take out, you know, a gnat on the back of a horse from miles away with your predator drones. And now why did you destroy an entire hospital and kill all of our staff? Hey, is it because we opposed the TPP agenda that also came out this same week? In other news, the war World War III, the war to end all wars to end all wars? Are we getting closer on that score? Well, the funny thing was this. This week, Russia, after moving troops and fighter jets and all kinds of things into the Syrian theater at the request of the Syrian government, decided they'd had enough of the United States posturing about ISIS. So basically it goes like this, and Putin was very circumspect. He knows how to play the game. He's a lot smarter than the guy with the imperial pen in the United States, it would seem, because he didn't come right out and accuse the United States of all the nasty things that the U.S. keeps accusing the Russians of, when in fact the whole world is watching and knowing darn well, when you blow up hospitals full of people, and when you do all these other kind of things, and when you arm and train ISIS and then prattle about terrorism, something is wrong. So the story is this. The U.S. says, oh, well, we're arming and training moderate terrorists. You guys don't understand the distinction there. Our terrorists, by definition, are good terrorists. But if they get out of line, we'll bomb them a little bit. And Putin and the Russians basically said, now we've had it with your posturing. And they went in there, and in less than a week, they bombed the living, you know what, out of ISIS. And literally had them on the run. They did stuff in less than a week that the United States has been trying to convince people, has been doing for a long time, to no effect. So it was suggested as of midweek or so that maybe, just maybe, since Putin had gone and told the world he was going to release a truth bomb. Release a truth bomb against the United States, that maybe this was it. So if you compare the U.S. bombing of insignificant targets, claiming that they were doing something, and the fact that the Russians actually then went out and bombed an ISIS command bunker, and they offered to share intelligence with the United States, and they tell us, hey, you tell us who you're bombing, we'll tell you what intelligence we have, maybe we can really actually go do something that you don't seem to be willing to do. Well, the U.S. ignored that. So the clown brigade goes on, it says here. But don't think that the world isn't watching and recognizing that while the U.S. is talking the talk, it's the Russians, amazingly, that are walking the walk. TPP came out this week, U.S. and a bunch of primarily Asian countries, all about a corporate takeover of the world. And the real news that was on the alternative press had to do with worldwide internet citizenship, saying, or censorship. Don't be fooled. TPP is not about trade. Only a tiny fraction of the chapters here have to do with trade. The rest has to do with setting up a corporate governance structure and making sure that it's a Monsanto Protection Act and a Big Pharma Protection Act. That, by the way, is the reason why Doctors Without Borders was so upset. They're saying that TPP will literally price a huge percentage of the world's population out of the ability to provide themselves with things like medicines. In other words, yet another lie. But the big threat seems to be to censorship of the internet. TPP will kill the internet, say a number of folks. I even saw a thing with WikiLeaks is going to post one of the chapters that they got all about how much of a threat TPP is that people in the U.S. aren't being told. Of course, they're not being told much of anything because Congress, even for the most part, isn't allowed to see the documents. So you got that going on. Today was the day, and evidently we'll have to wait for a while to see just how active the imperial pen was. But Barry Sotero, a.k.a. Emperor Obamas the First, in spite of being told by the city council and the sheriff and a lot of the government in a little Oregon town where the latest false flag came off a week ago, don't come. The emperor says, no, I'm going to come anyway. I'm going to politicize the heck out of this thing, and I'm going to dance on those graves. So he did. So he went there in spite of the objections of most of the local town and a protest that was held, and proceeded then to dance on their graves, and essentially to say, look, you people are stupid. You don't know that when we create these killing fields, and then it happens time after time after time after time that somebody takes advantage of these killing fields and does exactly what we know will happen, kills a bunch of folks there. Nobody can shoot back. He went to visit, well, he was gonna, I don't know whether the guy let him in or not, he was gonna go visit the hero who was disarmed, and so he had to go up with his bare hands against this guy, got shot at least 5 times for his trouble. He'd have been a lot better off if he'd had a weapon. You can't make this stuff up, I guess is the bottom line. And then you've got the woman who would be king today too, saying that, she called, one of the few groups that is, well, and it's not even a particularly good group. I'm a life member of the National Rifle Association, but not a fan. And I say that simply because years and years ago I saw that they were, not actually doing what they claimed they were doing. In other words, they were doing more lobbying than they were actually being absolutists. The Second Amendment says, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And I confronted Wayne LaPierre personally with a press pass one day in Denver on a day when the NRA was there supporting yet another anti-gun initiative. Imagine that. And I asked him, don't you know what shall not be infringed means? Well, here's the funny thing. Today you had the woman who would be king calling that same group absolutists, saying she stands against the absolutism of the NRA. For crying out loud, imagine that. Words like shall not. Who would have thought they could actually mean it? Now, this is a woman that also thinks thou shalt not murder doesn't apply to her, and thou shalt not commit adultery. Let's not even talk about that one, right? It irritates me when I see people who put their hands on a Bible and lie, then standing up and bad-mouthing other people because they, quote-unquote, take an absolutist stand about law that's written in genuine print. Because they know better. It doesn't apply anymore. And there you go, in a nutshell. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to do the news and then come back to the distinctions that are being made in Genesis. Because I think one of the big problems is we no longer know the difference, not between the kind of right and wrong that that fruit was supposed to provide people with, appearances only. You got lots and lots of people that can judge by appearances and cannot hear the word and walk in obedience to it. They think shall not doesn't apply to them. And they think that absolutism is a bad thing when it comes to understanding the difference between right and wrong. Another example. Listen to this. Well, now I'm not going to do it. Yet another, this case it's an Australian former climate modeler and mathematician for the Australian Greenhouse Office has come out and said he found a whole bunch of errors in the IPCC, the UN Climate Change Models, that explains how come every single stinking one of them has been wrong for the better part of 20 years. And he said, basically, when you look at the math and you do it correctly, the model architecture was wrong. Carbon dioxide causes only minor warming. The climate is largely driven by factors outside our control. Imagine that. Uh-oh. What were we talking about the difference between truth and lies? Can't be talking like that. Wonder if this guy will ever see a press report on him again. We'll come back to some of these other things later. Let me just close with a bit of good news. Monsanto. This is part of this. This is another one of those places where we tie a bunch of the dots together. The company that's called Monsanto, the genetically modified evil purveyor of Frankenfoods to the world, is crashing and burning. We need a little bit of good news. Monsanto shares have dropped 27% this year, and they've just now posted huge fourth quarter losses that were wider than estimates. Oops. Yeah, when you talk about Monsanto, they don't like that. Let's see if I can get back. All right, give me some ones if you're hearing me. Are we back in? Do I have ones again? Or do I have to leave the room? Ah, good, it works this time. Last week, every time Pal Talk did that, I had to leave the room. Anyway, so Monsanto shares are down 27% this year. They got huge losses, and they have announced they're going to have to lay off a bunch of people. Now, normally I would be really sympathetic, and I would say, hey, layoffs are not a good thing. But you know what? When people are working for a company who justly deserves the name Monsanto, and their job description basically is providing products that aren't products at all, that are purveyors of death and destruction and poison. No, they don't feed the world, folks. They're feeding the world a load of hooey. So I'm not that sympathetic. Praise Yah. But the story that I'm looking at here says that's not the whole story. In other words, it's not just like Bloomberg reports that the St. Louis-based agricultural giant has warned that their profits don't look so good next year because slumping commodity prices are hitting the company's bottom line. No, there may be more to it than that. For example, there are lots and lots of customers, former customers anyway, that don't want to eat genetically modified, herbicide-soaked, so-called food anymore. They would prefer organic. Hey, maybe that's a big reason why TPP is going to override labeling laws and secretly allow Monsanto to force that crap down people's throat, whether they like it or not, whether they know it or not. Really that simple. So that's one of the five reasons why Monsatan is having some problems. Another is lawsuits with farmers. As the story here points out too, they spend untold amounts of dollars suing family farms for patent infringement. Now normally what would happen is farmers would sue them for polluting their farms and destroying their crops. You've got all kinds of organic farmers that if a little bit of this crap comes across in the wind and contaminates their crop, they can no longer sell this stuff as pure food, organic. But no, that's not the way it works in the modern Monsanto-run legal system. They sue those farmers for being tainted by their patented Franken-crap. And it's not a great business model, says the story here, when your primary customers are other farmers. So they spend from their profits to sue people who aren't real happy about being sued or what they're doing to their neighbor farms. They also fund anti-labeling campaigns, and that's drained Monsanto of millions of dollars off their bottom line. It comes out of their marketing budget, and they've spent literally tens of millions of dollars defeating the right of the people to actually find out what kind of stuff Monsanto is sticking in their food. Finally, they have this problem. The World Health Organization has come out and admitted what people have known for quite some time that study after study have also pointed out, and that is that their flagship product, Roundup, glyphosate, is, quote, probably carcinogenic to humans. And the full effects of that aren't even being felt yet, but it begins with a number of cancer-stricken farm workers who are finally suing Monsanto over illnesses, with more likely to do the same. And let's not forget, especially in Euroland and the European Union, there are increasing numbers of countries, at least 15 EU member nations, that have moved to ban genetically modified Franken crops. And other small nations like Bermuda and Colombia have also banned glyphosate too. So all of that stuff is producing a problem for their bottom line. Again, that I think is the good news. And it's interesting because it shows that where people, in some cases, have the ability to make choices and to do what they know is right and eat food as opposed to not food and so forth, it still makes a difference. And so now you can see why all of this is coming to a head and why TPP is rearing its ugly head literally at the very same time that the economic meltdown is accelerating and Big Brother is announcing we are going to do everything we can, come hell or high water, to disarm you peons and confiscate your weapons. Yeah, Obama was talking about confiscation. He doesn't use the word, but he points to Australia and Great Britain, and that's exactly what they did. Everybody realizes that's what, if you read between the lines, he's talking about here. If you're going to poison people, if you're going to take away their right to communicate with one another, why not go ahead and disarm them too? Every other tyrant throughout history has found that to be a really effective thing. So I guess bottom line is the times and the seasons are getting really ugly. And if we are ruled by appearances, it would appear that we need more gun control. It would appear that we need more control. It would appear that what we need is trade agreements, when in fact it has nothing to do with trade. You know, in other words, all kinds of things that have a whole lot more to do with appearances than with actual law and with absolutism and with right and wrong. Maybe you could even argue that we deserve what we get. So let me ask this. Are there any questions, comments at that point? And we will head back into the Torah. I saw a couple of things there, and honestly, because we've got so much to talk about tonight, and I'm going to just So there, you know, you can read the screen. A couple interesting comments, but I'm not gonna deal with the language issues and all that kind of stuff. We'll talk about that later. What I do want to talk about is the portion. So let's briefly go through chapter 1. I've hit on a little bit of this, the first few verses anyway. In the beginning, Elohim created the heavens and the earth. They were tohu vabohu. The spirit of Yah, the Ruach, hovered over the face of the waters. He said, let there be light. There was light. And then he divided the light from the darkness. Now, in that sentence comes a theme that is going to appear several times in here about division. And I think that's key. As an engineer, that really appeals to me, this idea of a difference engine, of separation. Literally, almost everything in the universe. If you hear about the red dilemma and the end of the universe and how things, well, it's the second law of thermodynamics. Everything put together sooner or later falls apart. It's all about temperature differences that, you know, when they become zero, nothing moves anymore. What's wind? Wind is a difference between high pressure and low pressure, and it's a way of equalizing. What's heat flow? Well, if you got a high temperature source and a sink, a low temperature place, heat flows and you can do work. Energy moves with all of that. So differences are key to the entire functioning of the universe. If you think about the Big Bang, it is a time of separation. It's all about creating energy differences and potential differences and all kinds of things that drive all of the processes that follow. So that's part of the reason why I think this is a whole lot deeper, too. And physicists, the more I learn about physics, the more I learn about the Hebrew and the language and the scripture and the Torah, the more I find there is more and more depth in this description right here. He called the light day, the darkness night, evening and morning. There you go. That's why generally within the framework that most of us have now kind of at least begun to get used to, no, the day doesn't begin at midnight or the night. It begins at dusk, erev, and the evening and the morning, the first day or one day. And then Elohim said, let there be a firmament in the midst of waters. Let it divide the waters from the waters. So here we have another thing that is another division. He makes the firmament, divided the waters from above and below, and it was so. He called the firmament Hashemayim, heaven, or just Shemayim, and there was evening and morning a second day. Then he said, let the waters be gathered together. Let a dry land appear. Then he created the seas. And he said that was good. And then he said, okay, let's make grass and herbs yielding seed and fruit-bearing things after their own kind. Here we have an interesting separation, right? What is the difference between the crap that Monsanto's and other twisting concoctions of men do and the things that are created by God? Well, for one, herbs and seed and fruit propagate according to their own kind. The Franken stuff that Monsanto makes is genetically designed, aren't they clever, to not have the basic characteristic of propagating life. Well, it's not as profitable. They even patented the ability to put the killer gene in place and make darn sure that farmers in India and Iraq and all kinds of other places who have for thousands of years saved their seed can't do it anymore. So what do we got in India? The highest suicide rates in the world among farmers who are just basically saying, hey, you've destroyed my ability to run my business year after year. It's an evil, insanely nasty thing that's being done. And of course, in a depression, it just makes things worse if you think about it. Elohim, though, says that this idea of seed bringing forth more of its own kind was good. I guess you'd have to say that what Monsanto's doing by comparison, making a distinction, is Ra. There was evening and morning, there was the third day. Then he said, let there be lights in the firmament. Basically, these are lights in the firmament of heaven to give light upon the earth, stars, greater lights, lesser lights, moon, sun. and he put them above to rule over the day and over the night, to divide, here comes again that word, to divide the light from the darkness. And he says that too was good, tov, evening and morning, fourth day. Then let's put living creatures, swarms of them, in the waters, and let fowl birds fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. And he created great sea monsters and every living creature that creeps, things that swarm in the water after its kind, all kinds of winged fowl after their kind. That too was tov. And he blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply. Here comes the first commandment, as has been pointed out. Evening and morning, fifth day. And now we're going to populate the earth with living creatures after their kind, cattle, creeping things, and beasts. And it was so. That too was tov. And then we get around finally to where Elohim says, let us make man in our own image. And you notice that all of this uses the plural form of the Hebrew words here. When we get to the end of chapter 1, Elohim saw that everything he had made, behold, it was very good. Evening and morning, sixth day. Let's go back, though. I did get interrupted there. And note that he says to man, to Adam, behold, I've given you all of these things, herbs yielding seed, all of the things on the face of the earth, every tree, which there is a fruit of tree yielding seed, to be for you for food. And to the beasts of the earth, he's given these green things as food as well. And again, it was tov. It was not just tov, it was tov meod. It was very good. And then it says in chapter 2, the heavens and the earth were finished, all of the host of them. Now here I want to pause and just take a couple of additional comments. There are, according to those that do counting and so forth, seven places where things in this first chapter are called tov. And it ends, the portion, that is, ends in chapter 6, verse 5, with the first mention of something which is called evil. So we get tov, 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 a lot of stuff that's good. Not till the end of the portion do we find the word evil. But there is something missing on the second day. This was the day that there was this another separation made. And the firmament above, there was a division of the waters from the waters, things above divided from things below. And I'm going to keep coming back to that concept here because I think it's so important as we think about this idea of creation and all of the things that are being laid out for us, this idea of a difference. A difference between later, good and evil, the real sense, not just the appearance sense, and of distinction and discernment, and literally of a schism. And I guess, to some extent, if I was to say, what is it about mankind that separates, that distinguishes him from the animals? Well, we're going to talk about that. That's what the next couple of chapters are going to be about. We're going to have to go fairly fast because there is, like I said, so much to cover here. But so much of the rest of the book has to do with distinction, has to do with free will, and the ability of mankind to make a distinction between obedience to him and rebellion to him, between tov, the good, and the evil, the set apart and the profane, and so forth and so on. That is a theme. If there's a single theme that shows up in throughout Scripture, and Torah in particular, it's not just this idea of distinction. That's essential for there to be a choice. But the idea, too, of life and death, blessing and cursing, and choose life. If we don't have distinctions, if there aren't differences, if he doesn't separate things and give us an ability, more than just appearances, to use the brains and the intellect and the things that he has given us to make that choice, then really not much of anything else matters. Chapter 2 tells us that on the seventh day he rested. He rested from all that he had created and made, and then he blessed and set apart the seventh day and hallowed it, because on that day he rested from all of this creation. Now, I'll point out one other thing about this idea of the seventh day and the Sabbath and the rest. You notice that in almost all of creation, mankind in particular, there is a concept of a seven-day week. Isn't that amazing? Even though a lot of people don't keep a seven a seventh-day Sabbath, or the traditions of men have changed it. Isn't it fascinating that this idea of this seven concept, in fact, seems to predate a whole lot of what people call civilizations? The next few verses tell us about how the generations of the heavens and the earth, when they are created, and on the day in which Elohim, by the way, this is the first place, chapter 2, verse 4, where we see the word Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the Tetragrammaton, the capital L-O-R-D in the King James, appears, that he made earth and heaven. No shrub of the field was yet in the earth, because Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh had not yet caused it to rain, and there wasn't a man to till the ground, but there was a mist. And then it tells us more about something we've already heard once. He formed man from the dust of the ground. And now, I mentioned before that the word bara was creation out of nothing. This is not the same word. This is to form, literally like a sculptor crafts something out of something else. So he's not making man out of nothing. He is forming man from the dust of the ground. And then he breathes into him a neshama, the breath of life. Some would say that word neshama, same root that's also used for soul or for life. And man became a living nefesh. So we've got a couple of words here that are key to this this creation of man. This breath of life, and this idea of a soul, nefesh, the living part of us, and something different, the neshama that comes from him. He put the man in Gan Eden, the garden of Eden. Put all these nice things in there for him, all these trees that are pleasant to the sight, good for food, the tree of life in the midst of the garden, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. There was a river there. It tells us a little bit about the river and the minerals and good things that were there in the name. So I'm going to kind of quickly go through all of that and say, then we get commandment number one to the man. He is told, of every tree in the garden you can freely eat. But of that tree that's in the middle, the knowledge of good and evil, you're not to eat of it. In that day, you will surely die. And then he says, I'm going to make a helpmeet, etzer kenegdo, for man. This is something that I'm going to come back and talk a lot more about tomorrow in the details. I wish, and every time I read through this, I think, oh, there's just, again, there's so much incredible stuff here. He is going to bring all of these animals before Adam and find out what the man calls them. That's interesting. What about that? Well, in real brief, I'll say there's an indication here of dominion. We've already been told that part. And that dominion is exercised with this authority that he gives to the man. He brings these things before him. Now, he's obviously trying to teach him something, too. All of that's important. But the man then names them. And he finds out in the process there is not a suitable helper for him either. So here he takes the man, causes a deep sleep, and literally does the same thing to him that he did with the light and the darkness, and with the waters above and the waters below, and he separates the man and brings forth something from man, Isha, who we know later, well, she becomes wife, Isha, woman, and also later then he names her. Says the following, this is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. He names her generically first, calls her Isha, because she was taken out of man. Then it tells us this is why a man is to leave his father and mother and cleave to his Isha. And then it tells us what we've already alluded to, too. They were both naked, but they were not ashamed. They were not disappointed, confounded, disconcerted. And this brings us to chapter 3, and we're literally only halfway through the parsha. So let me just say it this way, folks. I'm going to talk about this part tomorrow, too. The Nechash, the serpent, is subtle. And here we have the first two big lies in human history. He starts not by offering up a lie. No, Chava, Eve, the woman, is the one who falls into the trap. What he does instead is he asks her a question. He says, yay, has Elohim said? How many times have we heard particularly insidious things begin like that? Has he said you're not to eat of any tree in the garden? She does the following. She adds just a little bit to it. And out of that, I guess that deception that she fell for, put in place herself, the Nakash kind of drives the truck through it. She makes the mistake, he ratifies the bad decision, and then the eyes of both of them were opened. There's this little discussion, fascinating stuff. And Elohim says several things. First, the man and the woman blame each other. Elohim speaks first to the serpent after the series of questions. Because you've done this, you, he says, are cursed. So the Nakash is cursed at this point. Does he curse man? Important. Read it carefully. He does not. He says to the woman, I will greatly multiply your pain and your travail, bringing forth children. And he says the following, your desire shall be to your husband. He will rule over you. He will have dominion over you. That's not a curse. It's one of those things that I guess is a blessing, really. He's providing, making clear the responsibility that was already implied by the fact that Adam ratified her decision. We don't know what would have happened had he not. But the one thing I think we can probably presume safely is that it would have been different somehow. Because he goes on and says this. To Adam, he says, because you have hearkened, you shamarred, you listened to the voice of your wife and eaten of that tree, which I told you not to. You obeyed her instead of me, in other words. Well, then what? Are you going to be cursed? No. Cursed is the ground for your sake. You'll eat of it in toil all the days of your life, and all those weeds and stuff are going to come forth out of it. Dust you are, dust you shall return. All right, now he gives his wife not only the generic name, he calls her Chava, because she is the mother of all living. And Elohim makes garments for them. And then he kicks them out. He shalaks them. He sends them out of the garden. Think of this as the first separation, the first divorce. They too are being separated from the place that he made for them. And he puts, of course, this cherub with a flaming sword to guard the way to the tree of life. Chapter 4, interesting story about Cain. And without going into detail and time that we're not going to spend at this point, we're going to see almost a word-for-word repeat of the things that were told by the creator of the universe to Adam and Chava to the things that are being told to Cain, as he begins to get to the point where he's going to kill his brother Abel. He too is then going to be separated and sent to a different place. He too is going to find that in this case, if you will, I heard it put this way, I liked it. The repetition, the parallels with the story of Cain and this idea of separation and of division and of the things that are going on here, that parallel the things that happened to his father and his mother, are kind of nothing short of incredible. But the story of Cain is darker. Not just rebellion, but death. And Cain is basically not just taken out, kicked out. He is told, you are cursed, unlike his father. Cursed art thou, verse 11, from the ground. Now the ground was cursed for Adam's sake. Now, Cain is told, cursed are you from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. And basically, you till it, ain't nothing going to happen. It's not like you're going to bring forth stuff and it's going to have weeds and stuff. It's going to not bring forth anything in your case. A fugitive and a wanderer you shall be upon the earth. All right. Then comes Cain leaves. We get a little description of some people that are born to him. And then we have the discussion of, well, let's just put it this way. A lot of genealogy and 1,000 years that pass. Well, more than 1,000 years. Down through Lamech, through Adam. He has another son, Seth. Chapter 5 says, this is the story. This is the book of the generations of Adam. Male and female, he created them and blessed them. If we choose to, and this is an interesting exercise, I would encourage everybody to go through it at some point. Set out a timeline. Tells you, Adam lived 130 years. He begot a son. His name is Seth. And then it tells us how long Adam lived after he begot Seth. You can find out how long his total life was. Just add the numbers up. And then we get to, well, it tells you in the next verse, in this case, 930 years he died. And then we get Seth, who begot Enosh, tells us how long he lived before and after, his total days. Enosh begot Kenan, and so on and so forth. You can literally put all these timelines together, and you can derive pretty precisely the next almost 2 millennium to bring us to the time of Methuselah. And the days of Methuselah, who dies not too long before the flood, and that brings us in turn to Noah. And of course, that's where we'll pick things up next week with Noah. So let's just pause at that point and say there is, again, there is a whole lot more here than we can possibly go through. I look forward to spending a little more time tomorrow talking about some of the details, and I would encourage everybody, read this, study it again. Every time we go through this, you'll see more and more incredible information, depth of material, and things that no matter how many times you read it, you can keep going back and saying, you know, has that been there all along? I never noticed that before. So I'll leave you with that and with this idea again of think about the distinctions. The whole story is about the distinction between good and evil and between, you know, what looks good to the eyes and what it is that we're told we need to understand. I guess that's part of the reason why I'd say some of us are, in fact, absolutists. There's so much in Scripture that if we read it and understand it, it does make certain things very clear. When the Creator of the universe says, don't eat it, he means it. When he says, don't kill, he means it. Don't murder. And similar things. We live in a world that has failed to make those distinctions, failed to teach those distinctions to our children, failed to make the distinction between things that come from the pagan world that appear really appealing to the senses, but that are lies, and that ultimately bring death. And there you go. We've got an introduction to the whole book in these 6 chapters and just a couple of 1,000 years.